Turquoise Days, Alistair Reynolds. New writer Alistair Reynolds is a frequent contributor to Interzone and has also sold to Asimov Science Fiction, Spectrum SF, and elsewhere. His first novel, Revelation Space, was widely hailed as one of the major SF books of the year. It was followed by a sequel, also attracting much notice, Chasm City. His most recent work is another big new novel, Redemption Arc. His stories have appeared in our 15th, 17th, 18th, and 19th annual collections. A professional scientist with a PhD in astronomy, he comes from Wales, but lives in the Netherlands where he works for the European Space Agency. Here, he takes us on a visit to a serene, peaceful, quiet little planet, a sea world, an idyllic world nearly covered by tropical turquoise oceans. But as we shall see, placid as things seem, you never know what's lurking beneath the surface, or when it's going to come out to get you. 1. Naki Okpik waited until her sister was safely asleep before she stepped onto the railed balcony that circled the gondola. It was the most perfectly warm and still summer night in months. Even the breeze caused by the airship's motion was warmer than usual, as soft against her cheek as the breath of an attentive lover. Above, yet hidden by the black curve of the vacuum bladder, the two moons were nearly at their fullest. Microscopic creatures sparkled 100 meters under the airship, great schools of them daubing galaxies against the profound black of the sea. Spirals, flukes, and arms of luminescence wheeled and coiled as if enthralled to secret music. Naki looked to the rear, where the airship's ceramic-jacketed sensor pod carved a twinkling furrow. Pinks and rubies and furious greens sparkled in the wake. Occasionally they darted from point to point with the nervous motion of kingfishers. As ever, she was alert to anything unusual in movements of the messenger sprites, anything that might merit a note in the latest circular, or even a full-blown article in one of the major journals of juggler studies. But there was nothing odd happening tonight, no yet-to-be-catalogued forms or behavior patterns, nothing that might indicate more significant pattern juggler activity. She walked around the airship's balcony until she had reached the stern, where the submersible sensor pod was tethered by a long fiber-optic drag line. Naki pulled a long, hinged stick from her pocket, flicked it open in the manner of a courtesan's fan, and then waved it close to the winch assembly. The default watercolored lilies and sea serpents melted away, replaced by tables of numbers, sinuous graphs, and trembling histograms. A glance established that there was nothing surprising here either, but the data would still form a useful calibration set for other experiments. As she closed the fan, delicately, for it was worth almost as much as the airship itself, Naki reminded herself that it was a day since she had gathered the last batch of incoming messages. Rot had taken out the connection between the antenna and the gondola during the last expedition, and since then collecting the messages had become a chore, to be taken in turns or traded for less tedious tasks. Naki gripped a handrail and swung out behind the airship. Here the vacuum bladder overhung the gondola by only a meter, and a grilled ladder allowed her to climb around the overhang and scramble onto the flat top of the bag. She moved gingerly, bare feet against rusting rungs, doing her best not to disturb Mina. The airship rocked and creaked a little as she found her balance on the top, and then was again silent and still. The churning of its motors was so quiet that Naki had long ago filtered the sound from her experience. All was calm, beautifully so. In the moonlight, the antenna was a single dark flower rising from the broad back of the bladder. Naki started moving along the railed catwalk that led to it, steadying herself as she went, but feeling much less vertigo than would have been the case in daytime. Then she froze, certain that she was being watched. Just within Naki's peripheral vision appeared a messenger sprite. It had flown to the height of the airship and was now shadowing it from a distance of 10 or 12 meters. Naki gasped, delighted and unnerved at the same time. Apart from dead specimens, this was the first time Naki had ever seen a sprite this close. The organism had the approximate size and morphology of a terrestrial hummingbird, yet it glowed like a lantern. Naki recognized it immediately as a long-range packet carrier. Its belly would be stuffed with data coded into tightly packed wads of RNA, locked within microscopic protein capsomeres. The packet carrier's head was a smooth teardrop, patterned with luminous pastel markings, but lacking any other detail save for two black eyes positioned above the midline. Inside the head was a cluster of neurons, which encoded the positions of the brightest circumpolar stars. Other than that, sprites had only the most rudimentary kind of intelligence. They existed only to shift information between nodal points in the ocean when the usual chemical signaling pathways were deemed too slow or imprecise. The sprite would die when it reached its destination, consumed by microscopic organisms that would unravel and process the information stored in the capsomeres. And yet Naki had the acute sense that it was watching her. Not just the airship, but her, with a kind of watchful curiosity that made the hairs on the back of her neck bristle. And then, just at the point when the feeling of scrutiny had become unsettling, the sprite whipped sharply away from the airship. Naki watched it descend back toward the ocean, and then coast above the surface, bobbing now and then like a skipping stone. She remained still for several more minutes, convinced that something of significance had happened, and yet also aware of how subjective the experience had been, how unimpressive it would seem if she tried to explain it to Mina tomorrow. Anyway, Mina was the one with the special bond to the ocean, wasn't she? Mina was the one who scratched her arms at night. Mina was the one who had too high a conformal index to be allowed into the swimmer corps. It was always Mina. It was never Naki. The antenna's meter-wide dish was anchored to a squat plinth inset with weatherproofed controls and readouts. It was century-old Pelican technology, like the airship and the fan. Many of the controls and displays were dead, but the unit was still able to lock on to the functioning satellites. Naki flicked open the fan and copied the latest feeds into the fan's remaining memory. Then she knelt down next to the plinth, propped the fan on her knees, and sifted through the messages and news summaries of the last day. A handful of reports had arrived from friends in Prachuap Pangnirtung and Umingmaktok Snowflake Cities, another from an old boyfriend in the swimmer corps station on Narathiwat Atoll. He had sent her a list of jokes that were already in wide circulation. She scrolled down the list, grimacing more than grinning, before finally managing a half-hearted chuckle at one that had escaped her. Then there were a dozen digests from various special interest groups related to the jugglers, along with a request from a journal editor that she critique a paper. Naki skimmed the paper's abstract, judging that she was probably capable of reviewing it. She scrolled through the remaining messages. There was a note from Dr. Sivaraksa saying that her formal application to work on the MOAT project had been received and was now under consideration. There had been no official interview, but Naki had met Sivaraksa a few weeks earlier when the two of them happened to be in Umingmaktok. Sivaraksa had been in an encouraging mood during the meeting, though Naki couldn't say whether that was due to her having given a good impression or the fact that Sivaraksa had just had his tapeworm swapped for a nice new one. But Sivaraksa's message said she could expect to hear the result in a day or two. Idly, Naki wondered how she would break the news to Mina if she was offered the job. Mina was critical of the whole idea of the moat, and would probably take a dim view of her sister having anything to do with it. Scrolling down farther, she read another message from a scientist in Kaanak, requesting access to some calibration data she had obtained earlier in the summer. Then there were four or five automatic weather advisories, drafts of two papers she was contributing to, and an invitation to attend the amicable divorce of Kugluktuk and Gjoa, scheduled to take place in 3 weeks' time. Following that, there was a summary of the latest worldwide news, an unusually bulky file, and then there was nothing. No further messages had arrived for 8 hours. There was nothing particularly unusual about that, The ailing network was always going down. But for the second time that night, the back of Naki's